Well, we've come upon the Christmas season once again, and one of the typical activities around this time of year is decorating for Christmas. It's become a holiday tradition. Many folks will utilize that long Thanksgiving weekend to put up the tree, the ornaments, and of course, the lights. Now, what began as simple illumination, legend tells us that Martin Luther used tiny candles on the first lighted Christmas tree. I'm not sure what the fire marshal would have thought of that at the time. But now we have all kinds of lights that not only go around the tree, but they are on the windows, the doors, the outside bushes. We have icicle lights in the gutters. I always love Christmas lights. I should probably amend that to say I love looking at Christmas lights. Putting them up is not so much fun, particularly those ones on the gutter. But I do love the colors. I love the cheeriness that Christmas lights bring. And I particularly like those of you that remember the old outdoor bulbs. You remember those, the great big bulbs? And for whatever reason, the blue ones, I always like the best. It's funny because blue has never been my favorite color by any means. But for some reason, just those blue lights, maybe the blue lights on the white snow, they're just something I really like about that. Well, during this month of December, I would like to focus our attention on the first Christmas lights. Now, I'm not suggesting that there were twinkling lights around baby Jesus' straw bed, nor were there icicle lights hanging from the manger. But rather, I refer to other lights that are a part of the birth of Jesus, and particularly how they still shine for us today. As you go back to that first Christmas story, the initial and perhaps the most obvious of these lights is the light of the star. We've been singing about that in the carols this morning. Paul Meyer writes in his book, First Christmas, "One of the most spectacular aspects of the Christmas story must be the great star which lured the wise men from their eastern homeland to Jerusalem and on again to Bethlehem. For that star never really disappeared. In silver or gold, plastic or cardboard, it crowns the tops of Christmas trees and twinkles among the festive trappings along Main Street. In glitter or aluminum foil, it shines on as the most familiar single motif on Christmas cards." And as you can see, we even have a star that adorns the top of our tree. The light of that star has captured imaginations ever since it first shone some 2,000 years ago. We read about it in the Bible. We sing about it in our Christmas carols. We display it in our nativity scenes and on our Christmas trees. But I believe there is still a message for us today in this very familiar symbol. It's what I call the guiding light of Christmas. Now, in our text that was read earlier from Matthew chapter 2, we begin with Jesus being born in Bethlehem. It has already taken place. Matthew tells us it was during the time of King Herod. And we are told, depending on your translation, that either wise men or magi came from the east. They were foreigners. These were Gentiles that had come into Jerusalem asking a very loaded question. Where is the one who was born king of the Jews? And you say, well, why is that such a loaded question? It's because this was asked during the reign of King Herod. Now, Herod the Great lived up to his nickname in many ways. He truly did some great things while he was in power. However, he was also a very severe paranoid. He suspected anyone and everyone of trying to remove him from his throne. He had several of his sons. He had his favorite wife put to death on suspicion of treason. He had his mother-in-law. Might be a little more understandable. We're not given all the details there. But you can imagine how the question of the wise men as they come into Jerusalem, where is he, born king of the Jews? That would have gotten Herod's paranoia boiling. Now we might ask, who were these men? As I mentioned, you have various translations, wise men. The NIV transliterates this from the Greek, magi. The first Christmas carol we sang this morning speak of, we three kings of Orient are. There's probably three things wrong right with the title of that Christmas carol. Number one, they weren't kings. These were not royalty of any sense of the word. They were probably employed by kings, but they themselves were not kings. Secondly, they were not from the Orient, at least what we think of as the Orient. If someone were to tell you that they had been on a trip to the Orient, where would you think they had gone? China, Japan, Korea, somewhere in that, what we now call the Far East. And if we think of these wise men bringing their camels in from China or Japan, we have the wrong impression. We're going to look at where they came from in a moment, but it was not the Far East, what we think of as the Orient. And also, there's no indication from the Scriptures that there were three. I know that all of our nativity scenes have the three wise men, and that's how we are generally told the story. The Bible never tells us how many magi there were. Where we get the three from are the gifts. They gave him three gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And so we just associate that one of these magi brought each of the gifts. But we don't know that. There may have been more. There may have been three. We just don't know. But what we do know is this. These magi were the closest thing in the ancient world to scientists. These were the educated. These were the men who studied for a living. And they studied all different kinds of science, including astronomy. They were experts for their day in the stars, the constellations, the patterns. You may not know this, but the practice of astrology actually dates back 1,000 or more years before the birth of Christ. And they would use the stars and they would use the alignment of the stars as indications of what was about to happen. So when we read of these wise men or the magi, they were considered the best and the brightest of the Gentile cultures. Now where did they come from? Matthew mentions that they came from the east. Many interpreters take this to mean the ancient land of Persia. Persia is now the land of Iran. Whenever you read of Babylon, that is present-day Iraq. But remember, there were many Jews that stayed in Persia. After the Babylonian exile, the Persian kingdom defeated the Babylonians. They took over. And it was the Persian king Cyrus who sent many of the Jews back to rebuild Jerusalem and to rebuild the temple. But not all of the Jews went. Some of them stayed. In fact, quite a number of them stayed. And so many feel that through the influence of these remaining Jews and the ancient world, particularly the kings who fashioned themselves as world emperors, they had a very open view towards competing religions. They thought everybody had a little bit of truth, so we're going to study all of them and try to get what we can. And so these men would have what we would call today comparative religions in their studies. And they would have been aware of what the Jewish scriptures had to say. There is another possibility. I'm not going to go into it at any length today. I've done so in a previous message about the wise men. But there's a possibility that they came from the ancient land of Sheba, which we now know of as southern Saudi Arabia. And that perhaps the reason why they would know about a star heralding the birth of a king is that the descendants of the Queen of Sheba, who, remember, came and visited Solomon and took back with her much of his wisdom, she may have also taken back with her a copy of the scriptures. The reason why Sheba is a possibility is because the gifts that they brought, the gold and the frankincense in particular, were found most abundantly in the land of Sheba. And in fact, there are some prophecies in the Old Testament from Isaiah and from others that say that kings and princes from the land of Sheba will come and worship the Messiah. So perhaps this is a fulfillment of that. But either way, they came from a Gentile land who obviously had some familiarity with the Jewish religion. We might ask, how did they come to this conclusion that a newborn king had been, in fact, born? There seems to have been two sources of this revelation. You have the testimony of the star, and you have the testimony of the scriptures. Verse 2 indicates the Magi said, "We saw his star in the east." Here we see the guiding light of the Christmas story, the star. Furthermore, the Magi call it his star. This isn't just any old star in the sky. This is his star. Now, what was that star? What was it that they saw so brightly in the night sky? The Star of Bethlehem has puzzled scholars for centuries. Some have just skeptically dismissed it all as a myth. This is just a literary device that Matthew uses. He kind of made the story up and embellished it to give credence to what he was saying here. Others have rejected all natural explanations and said it was just a bright light that God stuck in the middle of the sky and it was a miracle and that's it. We shouldn't look for any kind of natural explanation. Most authorities, though, take a middle course that looks for some astronomical and historical explanation for the Christmas star. Doesn't make it any less miraculous. It means that God worked through His creation to reveal something very important to these men. Now, without going into tedious detail, the most common natural possibilities are a triple conjunction of Jupiter, Saturn, and Mars, where they would have come together in the sky, and it would have looked like a very bright, a very large star. Furthermore, in the astrology of those times, each of those planets had a significance. Jupiter was the significance of power. Each of them coming together would have shown what God was trying to reveal. Also, possibilities could have been a comet, could have been a supernova, which is when a star is dying and it gives its final last ray of light. It's very bright and then it vanishes altogether. And any of these would have been visible to the naked eye at that time. You would not have needed the high-power telescopes of today to see these things. One of the things that lends credence to the first, that triple conjunction of the planets, is that astronomers can go back in time and see where these things were at various times. And in fact, those three planets were very close in the Middle Eastern sky right around 6 BC. Now, if the wise men saw the star before Jesus was born, and it may have been as much as 2 years, because we're told in this text that Herod asked, "When did the star appear?" And based on that knowledge, he sent his soldiers to kill all boy babies born, what? 2 years or less. So it's very likely they may have seen that triple conjunction of the planets in 6 BC. It took them that much time to understand its significance, gather what they needed, and make the trip, because it was a long journey, so that they would have arrived shortly after Jesus had been born. So it is a very real possibility. Whatever it was, though, God used nature to reveal to these pagan astrologers that something significant was taking place. In other words, God communicated to these men through a language they could understand. Now, it is true, and we'll see in a moment, He spoke through the Scriptures. But He brought together not only the Scriptures, but He brought nature to confirm the testimony. But we should never lose sight of the fact that God did and still does reveal Himself in His creation. Psalm 19, verses 1 through 4 states, "The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of His hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they display knowledge. There is no speech or language where their voice is not heard. Their voice goes out into all the earth, their words to the ends of the world." Paul writes in Romans 1:20, "Since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, His eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse." So God has put forth in the very universe He created evidences of His existence, of His power, and of His working among men. Now, we should not take this example as an endorsement of astrology. The Bible consistently condemns astrology. So if you're reading your horoscopes every day, quit. The Bible says don't do it. And we cannot use this example saying, well, look at there, God spoke through the stars to these astrologers. No, that is not how God normally communicates. Yes, He did speak to these particular men in a language they could understand. But that is not His normal means of communication. God has given us His Word, which is a far more accurate and fuller means of revelation. Though usually when His people are ignoring His Word, that God may have to use some other means to speak to those outside of the kingdom so that they might respond with a faith that quite frankly shames the indifference of the people who claim to be gods and who are custodians of His revelation. In fact, you see that in this story itself. Here come these Gentile pagan men traveling all this way and saying, "Where is the newborn king of the Jews?" Herod calls in the religious leaders and says, "By the way, where is the Messiah supposed to be born?" Just like that, they had the answer. "Oh yeah, Micah says that it's down in Bethlehem, 5 miles down the road." Do you think any of them went 5 miles down the road to check it out? Not one. And these are the people to whom God had given the Scriptures. These were the people that should have been the first ones there. And yet, they didn't care. So God will use other means, but we should not take that as a tacit approval of God on this practice. In fact, the testimony of the star is substantiated by the testimony of the Scriptures. Now, you can't just go to a passage of the Old Testament that says there will be a star shining above Bethlehem. It doesn't say it that clearly. However, it seems that they drew the connection between the star that they saw in the sky and Numbers chapter 24, verse 17. which reads, "A star will come out of Jacob, a scepter will rise out of Israel." Now the star is mentioned there. In fact, it's the only prophecy that mentions the word star. So these astrologers would probably gravitate toward that verse. But notice what the next part of the verse says. A scepter will rise in Israel. You know what a scepter is? A scepter is the stick, for lack of a better word. It was the thing that kings held. It was a sign of royal power. So what this verse is saying is not only that a star will come out of Jacob, but that a king will rise out of Israel. And so they may have put two and two together and come to the conclusion that this scripture is being fulfilled. They had heard the divine declaration through the star and through the scriptures. And as Chuck Swindoll notes, there was no question in their minds. The birth of Jesus represented the birth of a king. The star was his star. Clearly in their minds, he was the king of the Jews, and they had come to bow before him in worship. Now the story doesn't end with this divine declaration. In fact, it only begins there. See, others had been given the divine declaration. The Jewish leaders, as we mentioned already, had more information going for them than these wise men did. And yet they missed the birth of Christ completely. You see, it took a diligent determination on the part of the Magi to find the newborn King of the Jews. They took advantage of that divine declaration they had received. Just think about the efforts they would have to expend for this. They would have had to study both the stars and the scriptures to arrive at the conclusion that a newborn King of the Jews had arrived. They would have spent a small fortune preparing for the trip to Jerusalem, as well as these expensive gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. They would have had to make a very long trip through very difficult terrain, probably on camels. That's a challenge of its own. And they would have risked their lives by going into a hostile environment asking, "Where is the one born King of the Jews?" Now, honestly, we don't know why they originally came. It might have been political motivations. Maybe they were sent by the king of their land in order to establish good relations with this new king. Maybe they thought that this king would help the Parthians defeat the Romans. Or maybe they were looking for a new king to help unify two empires. Or maybe they were just curious about this long ago prophesied Jewish Messiah. But it also could have been that they were genuinely seeking the true God. Whatever their motivations were, they pursued their goal with a diligent determination. You say, all right, what do you mean by diligent? Consider these two verses from the Bible and how they define the term. Paul writes in 1 Timothy 4:15, "Be diligent in these matters. Give yourself wholly to them." That's what diligent means. Give yourself wholly. No half-hearted effort. We give of ourselves. You hear people talk about giving 110%. That's what's being talked about here. Now, in Hebrews, we see the same kind of parallelism, but from a negative angle. Hebrews 6, verses 11 and 12. "We want each of you to show this same diligence to the very end in order to make your hope sure." Now notice how he reverses the thought. "We do not want you to become lazy." What is the opposite of diligence? Laziness. If we want to truly find God, if we want to know God more, it is going to take diligence. But the enemy of diligence is laziness. And quite frankly, folks, our American culture caters to laziness. We want everything easy. We want everything instantly. We don't want to have to put the time and the effort into anything. We just want it handed to us. And it don't work that way. And it's not just a matter of being physically lazy. That's usually what we think of, someone who can't get out of bed in the morning. We can become mentally lazy by letting somebody else do all of our thinking for us. We can become spiritually lazy. We do not spend the time in prayer and in God's Word like we should. We are called to be diligent. I find it interesting that Herod told the Magi, if you have the King James Version, Matthew 2:8, go and search diligently for the young child. Perhaps he already knew that the Jewish leaders weren't going to do that. Now, this truth applies to all who would seek the Lord. Deuteronomy 4:29 says, But if from there you seek the Lord your God, you will find Him if you look for Him with all your heart and with all your soul. See, if we think we can have a one-day-a-week commitment to Christ, where we come and we put on our Sunday best, and I don't just mean our clothes, but our language and our behavior and everything else. We sit in church and we sing the hymns and we do all the things and we look like a good Christian, but boy, on Monday, nobody would recognize us. The rest of the week is a whole different story. That is not what it means to be faithful. That is not what it means to be diligent. It is something that consumes us. It is something that every part of our lives is in a pursuit after God. The Magi teach us that we need to seek the Lord diligently, to do so immediately, to do so intensely, regardless of the cost. And then at the end of this text, Matthew records the arrival of the Magi at their delightful destination. After they had talked to the king, he had said, go find the child. They go out. There's the star again. Right over the house where Jesus was staying. And they went, and it says that when they saw the star, they were overjoyed. Can you imagine going on such a long trip, not even sure where you're going, and there it is. Your final destination is in sight. If I could borrow a line from the end of the Declaration of Independence, these men had staked their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor on this mission. And now it had come to fruition. They were about to see the new King of the Jews. You know, we're probably familiar with the gifts of the Magi ever since we were in Sunday school. We might remember how gold signified that Jesus was a king, frankincense that he was God himself, and myrrh that he would be the sacrifice for the sins of the world. But you know, the greatest gift the Magi gave was none of those three things. It was the fact that they bowed down and worshiped him. They found Jesus, God the Son in human form, and they gave him their best. Not only the gifts that they brought, but they gave him themselves. And Jesus gave them an even greater gift in return. He gave them life everlasting. You know, there's a familiar slogan that says, wise men still seek him. And it's true. In all the world, there are only two kinds of people, those who are wise and those who are fools. You know, Herod was one type of fool who overtly rejected Jesus. The religious leaders, though, who counseled Herod were fools of a different kind. They didn't hate Jesus at this point. They just didn't care about him. They ignored him. They were too busy doing their own thing to be bothered by some baby that was born 6 miles away. They were too busy and wrapped up in themselves to bother with him, just like many people are today. The Magi, on the other hand, were truly wise men. Now, it wasn't very convenient for them to come to Jesus, but they realized they had no option. Although it meant great sacrifice for them, they diligently pursued until they found him. They represent every true wise man, and I might add, every true wise woman who has ever lived. How about us? God has given us His divine declaration through His works as well as His Word. We have more than enough information to go on. But it takes a diligent determination to discover and to be dedicated to Jesus Christ. When we do that, we will find the delightful destination of abundant life now and eternal life hereafter. This Christmas, the message of the Magi echoes down through the ages to our day. Follow the star. Follow the star. God's direction for your life, so that we may be truly wise.